a senior Russian financial official, the Trump operation was part of Putin's overall plan to sow disunity within the United States and the transatlantic alliance. This source reported having heard Putin express his desire to return to the 19th century style of great power politics, in which nations would pursue their own interests rather than an ideals-based international order. Source A, Steele reported, had confided that the Kremlin had been providing Trump and his team valuable intelligence on Clinton. The memo noted that Putin's cultivation operation had included offering Trump lucrative real estate development deals in Russia. But, Steele wrote, for reasons unknown, Trump has not taken up any of these. Then came the salacious details that would forever color the report. Steele alleged that Russian intelligence had been able to exploit Trump's personal obsessions and sexual perversion in order to obtain suitable kompromat. Source D, described as a close associate of Trump who had organized and managed his recent trips to Moscow, claimed that Trump's perverted conduct in Moscow included hiring the presidential suite of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, where he knew President and Mrs. Obama, whom he hated, had stayed on one of their official trips to Russia, and defiling the bed where they had slept by employing a number of prostitutes to perform a golden showers urination show in front of him. The hotel was known to be under FSB control, with microphones and concealed cameras in all the main rooms to record anything they wanted to. Another source cited in the memo claimed this bizarre event was believed to have transpired in 2013. That was when Trump was in Moscow for the Miss Universe contest. Steele reported that one of his Russian operatives had spoken to a female staffer at the hotel who confirmed the story. And source B, the former Russian intelligence officer still connected to the Kremlin, asserted that Trump's unorthodox behavior in Russia over the years had provided the authorities there with enough embarrassing material on the now Republican presidential candidate to be able to blackmail him if they so wished. When Burroughs, Steele's partner, reviewed the memo, he nearly gagged. "What the fuck?" Burroughs said to Steele during a testy conversation. "What the fuck is a golden shower? I never heard of it." Burroughs feared Steele was sensationalizing his material. "Why did you put the word perverted in there?" Burroughs asked. "Because that's what he said," Steele replied, referring to the collector, who was his primary source. "But does it have to be in there?" Burroughs asked. "You're being judgmental," Steele replied. Burroughs feared the political consequences of circulating such a document. "It's un patat chaude," he told his colleague, French for hot potato. "Are you sure about this?" Burroughs asked. "That was what the source said to me," Steele replied, referring again to the collector, whose information was, at best, second-hand. "I'm as sure as I can be." Steele's perspective was undoubtedly influenced by the FSB's rich history of using sexual kompromat and its key role in Putin's rise to power. In 1999, Russia's prosecutor general, Yuri Skuratov, was mounting an aggressive investigation into evidence of corruption of President Boris Yeltsin's inner circle. Among those implicated was Yeltsin's chief political advisor, his own daughter. Then a Russian television station aired a blurry black-and-white videotape showing two young women, described on the broadcast as prostitutes, cavorting in various states of undress with an older man who resembled Skuratov. A scandal erupted, and within a couple of weeks, the authenticity of the tape was validated by no less an authority than the director of the FSB, Vladimir Putin. Skuratov was later fired, and by then, an ever-grateful Yeltsin had designated Putin as his successor as Russia's president. The Skuratov video had all the trademarks of an old KGB operation frequently used during the Cold War to blackmail visiting diplomats and businessmen, and it remained an active part of the FSB playbook. In July 2009, a Russian news website was provided a video showing a portly British diplomat, James Hudson, frolicking with two blonde prostitutes during a visit to a brothel. The site posted the video under the headline, "Adventures of Mr. Hudson in Russia." It was enough to end Hudson's adventures. No sooner was it posted than the British diplomat was forced to resign, a new example of how kompromat remained a clear and present danger to all prominent visitors to Russia. But the fact that the FSB used sexual kompromat was not evidence that it had been employed against Trump. There was nothing in his report indicating how Steele's anonymous sources knew or could have known about the alleged golden shower incident involving Trump. The wording was vague. Source D was said to have been present at the hotel, but did this source witness the incident inside Trump's hotel room, speak directly to one of the prostitutes, or see the alleged tape? The memo provided no answers, and similar questions could be raised about the claims of Steele's other sources who purported to confirm the incident. If accurate, this memo could be the most consequential piece of opposition research in U.S. history. But Burroughs described the report as akin to preliminary intelligence reporting, information not analyzed, vetted, or ready for distribution. It was not meant to be definitive, Burroughs later observed. It was a report that needed to be explored further. This was not gospel. It was raw product. Simpson could barely wait for Steele's report. Steele had forwarded it on a thumb drive with a passcode via Federal Express. It was supposed to arrive in Washington on the morning of June 24th, Steele's birthday. That day he was celebrating with his wife, taking a stroll at Wisley, a Royal Horticultural Society garden outside London. It was also a momentous moment in Britain, the day after the Brexit vote that had turned the country upside down. Simpson was getting anxious. The FedEx package had not arrived. He kept calling Steele, interrupting his day off to ask, "Where is it?" Simpson had to fend off a burst of paranoia. Had it gotten lost, or had Russian intelligence intercepted the package? The explanation for the delay ended up being mundane. The buzzer to Simpson's office, in an unmarked office building near Washington's DuPont Circle, was not working. The next day, FedEx delivered the thumb drive. As soon as he read the memo, Simpson realized it could potentially blow up the election. But he also knew it was fraught with problems. He had not asked Steele to probe Trump's personal conduct, yet now he had these outlandish allegations in writing. How could they be proven? Who would believe it? He thought Steele was more worked up over this piece of the report than he was, but that was natural. Steele was the kompromat expert. And he saw Steele's focus of Trump's supposed sexual acts as a reflection of his proper British reserve. "Chris is like a Boy Scout," Simpson later remarked. "This is a guy who goes home to his wife and kids every night. He's more Le Carré than Fleming." Simpson would later learn from Steele the identity of Source D, the main source for the golden shower allegation. It was Sergei Milian, the Belarusian-American businessman who, in the mid-2000s, said he was retained to locate Russian customers for Trump properties in the United States. Like all of those who had spoken to Steele's collector, Milian was an unwitting source. He had no idea his conversation with the collector would be passed along to Trump's political foes. For Simpson, Milian was now an investigative target. He tipped off ABC News, which conducted an on-air interview with Milian, in which he said, "Trump likes Russia because he likes beautiful ladies, talking to them, of course." The memo had described Milian as a Trump intimate, but there was no public evidence he was close to the mogul at that time or was in Moscow during the Miss Universe event. Had Milian made something up or repeated rumors he had heard from others to impress Steele's collector. Simpson at times had his doubts. "Sergei is a big talker, he's a braggart," Simpson later remarked. For his part, Milian subsequently insisted on Russian television, "I don't have any compromising information on Trump, neither in Russia nor in the United States, nor could I have." Steele's faith in the sensational sex claim would fade over time. Much later, after this report and follow-up memos would become infamous, Steele would say that he believed 70-90% of the broad assertions of his reporting, that Russia had mounted a campaign to cultivate Trump and had colluded with the Trump campaign, was true. Burroughs would assess the level of accuracy at 70-80%. But asked about the likelihood of the claim that prostitutes had urinated in Trump's presence, Steele paused for a moment and replied, "It's 50-50. Note, Steele would later wonder if there was a connection between Trump's 2013 visit with Emin Agalarov and Rob Goldstone to a Las Vegas nightclub, The Act, which sometimes featured women urinating on each other, and the Golden Showers story in his first memo. But he didn't know. End of note. When Simpson first received Steele's report, however, the main question was how to corroborate the more consequential allegations about a Trump-Russia connection. Some of the material in the report, Simpson recalled, was hard to believe. I assumed a lot of it would be wrong. While the lurid stories were practically impossible to verify, the other big-picture claims, the Russians had been trying to cultivate Trump and there had been secret information sharing between the Trump camp and Moscow, might be true and confirmable and possible ammunition for Trump's foes. Yet neither Simpson nor Steele were aware of recent events that would later lend weight to some of these claims. Trump, just months earlier, had been in the middle of a potentially lucrative deal to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. One of his foreign policy advisors, George Papadopoulos, had been in regular contact with Russian sources in an attempt to set up a meeting between Trump and Putin. And days before Steele began his inquiries, Trump's top advisors had met with a Russian delegation at Trump Tower, seeking derogatory information from the Kremlin on Hillary Clinton. Soon after sending Simpson the memo, Steele made an unnerving suggestion. They should share this report with the FBI. Steele believed this information, a presidential candidate possibly being compromised by Putin's regime, was too important to reserve as confidential campaign oppo research. "This is a grave national security threat," he told Simpson. The former MI6 man explained that he felt obligated to report it. Simpson immediately saw that this could create a problem. If he brought this information to the FBI, such a move could be portrayed as a partisan effort to manipulate the Bureau and instigate an investigation of a political rival. Should that become public, it would be political suicide for the Clinton campaign. Moreover, Clinton remained under investigation by the FBI in the email server case. Too many Clinton officials did not trust the Bureau. There was no way the campaign would want to approach the FBI with such dicey material. He told Steele to hold off. But in a series of calls, Steele kept pushing. This was intelligence, he argued, which needed to be shared with the appropriate government officials. "I wouldn't even know who to call," Simpson said at one point. Steele replied, "Oh, I know who to call." Finally, Simpson relented. He knew this was a momentous step, but he had his doubts. "The way I justified it to myself was this was a crime in progress," he later explained. After all, what if a research project turned up advance knowledge of a terrorist plot? Of course he would call the cops. In this case, it appeared possible that a foreign intelligence service was covertly manipulating the American election. Steele was now free to tell the FBI, and Simpson, said not a word about this to Elias. Steele called Michael Gaeta, his FBI contact on the FIFA case. "I've got something you should see," he said. "I can't discuss it over the phone. You have to come here. Believe me, Mike, you have to come to London." There were a few hoops Gaeta had to jump through. He was assigned to the U.S. Embassy in Rome. The FBI checked with Victoria Nuland's office at the State Department. "Do you support this meeting?" Nuland, having found Steele's reports on Ukraine to have been generally credible, gave the green light. Within a few days, on July 5th, Gaeta arrived and headed to Steele's office near Victoria Station. Steele handed him a copy of the report. Gaeta, a seasoned FBI agent, started to read. As he did so, according to Steele, he was speechless. He goes white. For a while, Gaeta said nothing. Then he remarked, "I have to report this to headquarters." Chapter 12. As for the Ukraine amendment, excellent work. On the morning of July 5th, all work stopped at Clinton headquarters. Staffers crowded around television sets. There was absolute silence. Within moments, the fate of Hillary Clinton's quest for the presidency could be decided. In a conference room at the FBI headquarters, James Comey, the tall and imposing FBI chief, strode to a podium. Comey, a Republican, had been appointed head of the Bureau by Obama 3 years earlier. As a deputy attorney general and U.S. attorney, he had developed a reputation as a straight shooter. In a now famous incident, he had rushed to a hospital room in 2004, where then Attorney General John Ashcroft lay ill, to stop senior Bush White House aides from pressuring Ashcroft to reauthorize a domestic warrantless wiretapping program that Comey and other officials believed was illegal. The event cemented Comey's reputation as a principled law enforcement officer who truly was above politics. Standing in front of the flags of the United States and the FBI, Comey was about to announce whether the FBI would recommend the indictment of a presidential candidate. Comey started off acknowledging this was an unprecedented moment. The Bureau never revealed its findings in such a manner. Typically, if an FBI investigation resulted in an indictment, the charges themselves would stand as the main statement on the case. And if there were no indictment, under Justice Department rules, the Bureau would not comment on what it had or had not uncovered. But Comey explained that due to the intense public interest, he was going to provide more than the usual details. He noted that he had not coordinated or reviewed what he was about to say with the Justice Department, of which the FBI was a part, or any other part of the U.S. government. Comey did not explain that one reason he was taking this action on his own was that he and his senior aides had been chafing about Attorney General Loretta Lynch's role in the Clinton email server probe. The previous September, as Comey was preparing to testify before Congress, Lynch had ordered him to refer to the Clinton email inquiry as a matter, not an investigation. It was a directive that Comey viewed as absurd and designed to conform with Clinton's own misleading talking points that the FBI's criminal probe was merely a security review. "I guess you're the Federal Bureau of Matters now," one national security prosecutor cracked after the meeting. And in late June, Lynch had met with Bill Clinton when he had boarded her airplane while they both were on the tarmac at a Phoenix airport. Their half-hour chat, Lynch later said, was primarily social, about golf and grandchildren. The encounter caused a storm of criticism, given that Hillary Clinton was still under investigation by Lynch's department. "I wish I had seen around that corner and not had that discussion with the former president, as innocuous as it was, because it did give people concern," Lynch said a few days later. In response to the uproar, Lynch said she would accept the recommendations of career prosecutors and the FBI on the Clinton case, whatever they were. Comey also did not reveal his concern about something else. Months earlier, the FBI had obtained a purported Russian intelligence document that suggested Lynch would not let the Clinton investigation go too far. Though there were questions about its validity, Comey feared that the document could leak and cast a further cloud over any decision the Justice Department announced about Clinton's server. It was the job of Justice Department prosecutors, not the FBI, to make the final decision on whether criminal charges would be brought in any investigation. But in this instance, Comey chose on his own to leave the Justice Department out of the picture and publicly announce the FBI's recommendation himself. He began to read a statement he and his senior staff had been drafting and redrafting for weeks. At the lectern, Comey explained all the steps the Bureau had taken during its probe. Agents, he reported, had searched through millions of email fragments on one of Clinton's personal servers. The Bureau had reviewed the 30,000 emails she had returned to the State Department and found 110 emails on 52 email chains that contained classified information at the time they were sent. Seven of those chains involved matters that were at the top secret or special access program level. This contradicted Clinton's repeated claim that she had not used the private email server to transmit classified information. Another 2,000 emails contained information that was later determined to be classified. The Bureau found several thousand work-related emails that were not in the group of messages Clinton had returned to the department. Comey suggested that Clinton's lawyers did a shoddy job in reviewing her emails for State Department-related messages. In the Brooklyn headquarters, hearts began to sink. Classified information, missing emails, it appeared Comey was going to announce an indictment. That would be it. Some of her aides believed the campaign was finished. Comey began to sum up his conclusions. Although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information. It was a damning and extraordinary statement for the FBI director to make. The Clintonites, staring at television screens, could not tell where Comey was heading. Then there was the question of whether foreign powers had intercepted Clinton's emails, a pressing national security issue. The Bureau did not find direct evidence that her server had been hacked, but Comey noted that Clinton had used her personal email extensively while traveling overseas, including in the territory of sophisticated adversaries. He added, "Given that combination of factors, we assess it is possible that hostile actors gained access to Secretary Clinton's personal email account." Finally, Comey remarked that the FBI had not found evidence that Clinton had engaged in willful misconduct or sought to obstruct justice, key factors in any decision to prosecute. Although there is evidence of potential violations of the statutes regarding the handling of classified information, he said, "Our judgment is that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case." Clinton was in the clear. A cheer erupted in the Brooklyn campaign office. Top aides huddled afterward and wondered if they should challenge Comey on his biting statements criticizing Clinton's conduct. After a brief deliberation, they decided it would be counterproductive. Did they want to put Clinton, whose integrity was a campaign issue, in a direct confrontation with the head of the FBI? His statement was a split decision, but one they could live with. It seemed that the email server episode was over, but another FBI inquiry into Donald Trump's campaign was about to begin. When the first Steele memo arrived in FBI headquarters that same week, it got the attention of the Bureau's Counterintelligence Division. The officials there knew about Steele's track record providing reports that were helpful in the FIFA soccer corruption investigation. They also knew from the outset that Steele had an agenda and that he was likely working for the Democrats. But this was not a deal breaker, according to one senior official who reviewed Steele's report at the time. FBI agents are used to receiving intelligence from informants with agendas or grudges. Gang leaders and drug cartel bosses dime out their competitors, and agents and prosecutors are happy to take the information if it checks out and helps them make a case. It was a concerning document, recalls the former senior official. Of course, we took it seriously. Within days, a rambling and boring lecture in Moscow ratcheted up the Bureau's concerns. In the spring, Carter Page, the little-known energy consultant who had been named a Trump advisor, was invited by the rector of the prestigious New Economics School in Moscow to deliver a speech there. Although a private university, the school had direct ties to the Kremlin. Arkady Dvorkovich, Russia's deputy prime minister, was the chairman of its board. Page asked Trump campaign official J.D. Gordon for permission to travel to Russia for the event. Gordon was essentially Page's handler on the campaign, and his relationship with Page was not a smooth one. Page wanted high-level access and to be part of senior-level strategizing. In May, he had sent an email to Gordon suggesting Trump visit Russia to raise the temperature a little bit. No campaign official jumped at this suggestion. Page also wrote policy papers for the campaign, but only one was accepted. The subject? Energy and hydraulic fracking. When Trump made an energy speech in North Dakota, Page flew to Bismarck for the event. Yet none of his material was used. Page was irate. "Nothing I gave you was in the speech," Page subsequently complained to Gordon. "Not my problem," Gordon told him. Page had grandiose ideas about his future role in a Trump administration. In his heart of hearts, Gordon later said of Page, he wanted to be U.S. ambassador to Moscow. When Page told Gordon that he wanted to go to Moscow for a speaking engagement, Gordon thought to himself, "No flipping way. This is a really dumb idea. I'll get my face ripped off." He refused to forward his speech request form. But the energy consultant would not take no for an answer and went over his head. In an email, he appealed to Corey Lewandowski, then Trump's campaign manager. Lewandowski said okay, but Page would have to travel to Moscow in his private capacity, not as a representative of the Trump campaign. On July 7th, Page appeared on stage in an auditorium at the New Economic School in Moscow to deliver a talk on U.S.-Russian economic relations. At the start of his presentation, Page insisted he was speaking only as a private citizen and a business executive. Russian officials could be forgiven for believing that Page was bearing a message from Trump. After all, Trump had repeatedly spoken about improving relations with Russia and getting along with Putin. And Page was known as something of a Putin fan. In a 2014 blog post, after Obama had added Igor Sechin, the chairman of Rosneft, the state-owned oil company and a close Putin ally, to the sanctions list, Page had declared, "Sechin has done more to advance U.S.-Russian relations than any individual in or out of government from either side of the Atlantic over the past decade." And at a June meeting of Washington foreign policy experts with the Indian Prime Minister, Page stunned the crowd by praising Putin as stronger and more reliable than Obama. Now, before the 200 or so college students who had gathered in the auditorium at the school, Page, reading off his laptop in a painful monotone, described U.S.-Russian economic interactions. Soon into the lecture, some students looked as if they were having trouble staying awake. But Page's message was provocative for an advisor to a Republican presidential candidate. He denigrated U.S. policymakers for their hypocritical focus on ideas such as democratization, inequality, corruption, and regime change when dealing with Russia. He called for Washington to put aside its critical tone and intolerance, to not fixate on corruption, and instead to exploit opportunities to build upon mutual interest with Russia. He decried that the West unnecessarily perpetuated Cold War tendencies. he was urging Washington to not get hung up on the Putin regime's human rights abuses, lack of transparency, political repression, and culture of corruption. Mutual respect, he contended, would yield mutual benefits. At least, the deals and the money would flow. It was a theme that the Putin establishment, no doubt, relished. At least one influential Russian openly embraced Page's appearance in Moscow. Alexander Dugin, a Kremlin-connected political scientist known as the Mad Philosopher, who had urged Russians to kill Ukrainians, promoted Page's lecture. A big fan of Trump and a hardcore ultra-nationalist, Dugin had produced a series of videos hailing the Republican candidate. Now he praised Page for promoting an alternative for the U.S., and on Tsargrad, a TV station he founded, he broadcast Page's lecture live. While in Moscow, Page declined to tell a Reuters reporter whether he would be meeting with anyone from the Russian government. But Page did speak after his speech, briefly, he later said, with Dvorkovich, the deputy prime minister who chaired the board for the school. And afterward, Page sent the campaign a memo, noting, Dvorkovich expressed a strong support for Mr. Trump and a desire to work together toward devising better solutions in response to the vast range of current international problems. Page also met with Andrei Baranov, the head of investor relations for Rosneft, which was subject to U.S. sanctions, and he boasted to the campaign that he had been in contact with top Russian officials during this trip, emailing J.D. Gordon that he would soon send a readout about his trip regarding some incredible insights and outreach I've received from a few Russian legislators and senior members of the presidential administration here. Page's speech may have been a snooze, but his time in Moscow caught the attention of the FBI. That was in large part because he had been known to the Bureau's spycatchers for at least 3 years. In 2013, Page had attended an energy symposium in New York City and met a Russian diplomat named Viktor Podabny. The Russian gave Page his business card and his email addresses. Over the following months, Page and Podabny corresponded and met occasionally. Page freely shared with the Russian his thoughts on the energy industry, and he passed along documents related to the energy business. The Russian hinted that he had connections in the Russian government that could help Page obtain contracts. Page had been suckered. Podabny was a Russian intelligence officer working for the SVR, Moscow's Foreign Intelligence Service. He was part of a three-man spy ring that had been handed the assignment of gathering information related to potential U.S. sanctions against Russia, American efforts to develop alternative energy, and other economic topics. Podabny did not think too highly of Page. During a conversation with one of his spying comrades that was intercepted by U.S. intelligence, Podabny called Page an idiot who wants to earn lots of money. He noted that Page often flew to Moscow, and he remarked that it was easy to fool Page, noting, "His enthusiasm works for me." Podabny told his colleague that he was feeding Page empty promises and described his recruitment method this way. "You promise a favor for a favor. You get the documents from him and tell him to go fuck himself." FBI agents, though, were on to the Russians, and in June of that year, two agents interviewed Page about his contacts with Podabny. He told them he had passed to Podabny only publicly available materials and excerpts from lectures he was giving while teaching a course at New York University. In 2015, the FBI broke up this espionage operation and brought charges against one of the spies, Yevgeny Buryakov, who had been posing as a Russian banker. Podabny and the other Russian in the ring each were protected because they had been working undercover as diplomats, and they quickly left the United States. Buryakov was eventually sentenced to 30 months in prison. Page had not been accused of any wrongdoing, and his peripheral role did not become public. But the operation placed him on the FBI's radar screen, and his trip to Moscow in July 2016 rang a bell within the bureau, raising concerns about whether one of Trump's foreign policy advisors was being manipulated by the Kremlin. In mid-July, the Republicans descended upon Cleveland for their national convention. There was little drama left in the GOP race. Earlier talk of a Republican effort to block Trump's ascension at the convention had evaporated. The party was now Trumpified. Delegates roamed the streets of the city wearing Hillary for Prison 2016 t-shirts. And Republican lobbyists, the denizens of the rigged system and the swamp Trump excoriated, held receptions and resigned themselves to Trump being their nominee. Mainstream Republicans shared the consensus of the politerati. This political novice running a dark campaign brimming with anger, if not bigotry, was unlikely to succeed in November. The party would have to grin and bear its way until the election, and then find a new path forward. Trump's curious relationship with Putin and Russia was never advertised from the podium inside the Quicken Loans arena, but questions about the Trump campaign's ties to Moscow were lurking in the background. On the afternoon of July 18th, the opening day of the convention, Michael Flynn, now Trump's high-profile national security advisor, came to the Yahoo News booth for an interview with Chief Investigative Correspondent Michael Isikoff. Flynn was there to promote The Field of Fight, a new book he had just written with Michael Ledeen, a hardline neoconservative. In the book, Flynn called for ramping up the war against jihadi terrorism and more forcefully confronting the mullahs in Iran. And he took a tougher line on Russia than he had before, slamming Moscow for supporting the Iranian regime. At the end of the interview, Isikoff raised an issue Flynn was not eager to discuss, his December 2015 trip to Moscow for the 10th anniversary celebration of RT, the Russian propaganda channel, where he had sat at the VIP dinner table next to Putin. The interview grew testy. Isikoff, were you paid for that event? Flynn, you'd have to ask the folks I went over there to. Isikoff, well, I'm asking you. You'd know if you were paid. Flynn, yeah, I went over as a speaking event. It was a speaking event. What difference does that make? Yeah, somebody can go, oh, he's paid by the Russians. Isikoff, well, Donald Trump has made a lot of the fact that Hillary Clinton has taken money from Wall Street, Goldman Sachs. Flynn, well, I didn't take any money from Russia, if that's what you're asking me. Isikoff, well then, who paid you? Flynn, my speaker's bureau. Ask them. That afternoon, a story about the interview was posted on the Yahoo website, highlighting Flynn's trip to Russia. Flynn shot Isikoff an email. Of all we spoke about today, the headline is my speaking engagement in Russia? That's not news of any substance. Did you really read my book and see how much I took Russia to task? That evening, Flynn gave a stemwinder of a speech to the convention. He led the raucous crowd in fierce cheers of lock her up as he vilified Clinton for putting our nation's security at extremely high risk with her careless use of a private email server. He declared, if I did a tenth of what she did, I would be in jail today. On the third evening, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, whom Trump had chosen as his running mate, excoriated Clinton and Obama for being feckless caretakers of national security. One sign of their weakness, he insisted, was feigning resets with Russia. He vowed that Trump would stand with our allies. Yet, that same night, Trump signaled the opposite. In an interview with the New York Times, he said he might not honor the NATO obligation to protect fellow members of the alliance if they were attacked. This was major news and exactly what Putin wanted to hear. As the Times noted, Trump was arguably conveying to Russia that he might accept aggression from Moscow. When Trump delivered his acceptance speech, he said nothing about Russia or Putin. He stuck to his usual script, presenting a dystopian view of a United States overrun with crime and endangered by illegal immigration. He blasted Clinton for committing terrible, terrible crimes. The man who months earlier had secretly tried to land a deal in Moscow claimed that Clinton had raked in millions of dollars trading access and favors to special interests and foreign powers. He proclaimed, "I am your voice." There were few surprises during the official proceedings. Far more intriguing was what was going on behind the scenes. During the week of the convention, several Trump associates met with Sergei Kislyak, the longtime Russian ambassador to the United States, at a conference co-sponsored by the State Department and the Conservative Heritage Foundation. Sessions delivered the keynote address for that event. Afterward, he chatted with Kislyak and other ambassadors. Subsequently, the Russian ambassador reported back to Moscow that the two had discussed Trump's positions on policy matters of concern to the Russian government. U.S. intelligence captured Kislyak sharing this news with his superiors back home. J.D. Gordon and Carter Page also had a chance to chat with Kislyak. At an evening reception that was part of this conference, Kislyak spoke briefly with Gordon as Page stood by. The discussion, according to Gordon, centered on improving U.S.-Russia ties. "It's important to have better relations between the U.S. and Russia," Gordon told the ambassador. "We should cooperate against jihadi networks." Kislyak, while nibbling on chicken satays, nodded in agreement. So too did Page. These encounters with Kislyak attracted no public notice at the time, but there was a Russia-related controversy at the convention that did draw attention, and it started the week before during a bitter fight over the party platform's plank on Ukraine. The GOP platform committee was holding one of its last meetings in Cleveland to finish up the policy document that would be presented to the delegates at the convention for their approval. Gordon was assigned the task of monitoring the process to ensure that no national security-related amendments at odds with Trump's positions ended up in the platform. Enter Diana Denman, a one-time aspiring actress and a veteran Texan GOP activist. She considered herself a proud Reagan Republican and had come to Cleveland as a delegate for Ted Cruz, the Texas senator who had placed a distant second to Trump in the nomination battle. In 1998, Denman had served as an election observer in Ukraine, and since then, she had identified with the Democratic and anti-Russian forces in that country. As a member of the Platform Committee's National Security Subcommittee, she introduced an amendment condemning Russia's ongoing military aggression in Ukraine. Her measure called for maintaining and possibly intensifying sanctions against Russia, and it proposed providing lethal defensive weapons to Ukraine's armed forces. Ukraine had been asking the United States for arms. Despite support from some officials in the Pentagon, Obama had rejected the idea and favored sending non-lethal assistance. Immediately, Denman could tell something was wrong. Two men who were watching from the side quickly stood up and headed over to Steve Yates, the head of the Idaho GOP, who was co-chairing the National Security Subcommittee, and began discussing the language of her amendment. Denman joined the group and asked, "Who are you? What's the problem?" One of the men was Gordon. "Are you a staffer?" Denman asked. "No," he said, "he was with the Trump campaign." The wording of her amendment, Gordon told her, had to be cleared. "With whom?" Denman demanded to know. "New York," he said, according to Denman. She snapped back, "Do you have a problem with people who want to be free?" Gordon knew the amendment could be a problem. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist to know that arming Ukraine was not consistent with Trump's position, he later said. It was Gordon's job to make sure Trump's views were reflected in the platform, and that there wouldn't be headlines along the lines of GOP Platform Committee Rebukes Trump. Gordon urged Yates to push the pause button, explaining he had to talk to other campaign officials about this. He called John Mashburn, the campaign's policy director, telling him he needed to get to the meeting immediately. Another campaign aide called Dearborn, a senior campaign official, to deliver the same message. Dearborn showed up, hopping mad. "Why are you calling me?" he demanded to know. Gordon explained the situation, and Dearborn agreed that the amendment had to be killed. A new version of the amendment was crafted and approved. It still called for maintaining and possibly increasing sanctions on Russia until Ukraine's territorial integrity was restored. But the reference to supplying weapons to Ukraine was gone. The Trump aides thought they had dodged a bullet. The campaign certainly did not need a controversy at the convention that would call attention to Trump's unconventional stance toward Putin. But that's what it got. On the first day of the convention, the Washington Post revealed what had happened during the platform meeting, reporting, "The Trump campaign worked behind the scenes last week to make sure the new Republican platform won't call for giving weapons to Ukraine to fight Russian and rebel forces, contradicting the view of almost all Republican foreign policy leaders in Washington." This boosted an inconvenient storyline for the campaign, that Trump was too cozy with Putin. Moreover, this prompted media attention regarding Manafort and his years of profitable work for Yanukovych and the Party of Regions. There was no evidence that Manafort had been involved. Yet, after the platform battle, Page shot Gordon an email. "As for the Ukraine amendment, excellent work." In mid and late July, Christopher Steele sent new reports to Glenn Simpson based on his conversations with his collector. They were as alarming as his first memo. One of the reports focused on Russian state-sponsored hacking. It asserted the FSB was using coercion and blackmail to recruit hackers as part of a massive campaign to target Western governments and corporations. Russia's secret police had achieved significant operational success by inserting malware into cheap Russian IT games. Another cited further evidence of an extensive conspiracy between Trump's campaign and the Kremlin that had been sanctioned at the highest levels of the Russian government. This conspiracy, the report said, was being managed within the Trump campaign by Manafort. It claimed there was an agreed exchange of information in which Trump's team were using moles within DNC and hackers in the U.S. to provide intelligence to Russia. It made further claims about Trump's efforts to do business in Russia. It asserted that while the real estate mogul had explored the market in St. Petersburg as well as Moscow, in the end, he had to settle for the use of extensive sexual services there from local prostitutes rather than business success. A third report focused on Page's trip to Moscow. It claimed that the Trump advisor had held secret meetings in Moscow. One of them purportedly was with Igor Sechin, the president of Rosneft, the giant Russian state-owned gas company, who as a Putin intimate had been sanctioned by the Obama administration over Russia's intervention in Ukraine. According to Steele's report, Sechin had raised the issue of future bilateral U.S.-Russia energy cooperation in exchange for lifting Western sanctions on Russia. Another secret meeting, the memo alleged, was with a Kremlin official named Igor Divakin, who supposedly told Page about a dossier of kompromat that the Kremlin had compiled on Hillary Clinton and its possible release to the Republicans' campaign team. Page later adamantly denied he held any of the secret meetings described in the memos, but admitted he had met with Andrei Baranov, the investor relations chief at Sechin's company. As with Steele's first report, none of the sources in the memos were identified. Steele later said one of the sources for the information was the paramour of a Kremlin insider. In short, it was pillow talk. Chapter 13. Next, they're going to put polonium in my tea. The tweet that shook the 2016 election popped up at 7:26 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on July 22nd. It was the Friday before the Democratic National Convention, and delegates from across the country were heading to Philadelphia to nominate Hillary Clinton for president. "Are you ready for Hillary?" asked the tweet from Julian Assange's WikiLeaks. "We begin our series today with 20,000 emails from the top of the DNC. For weeks, Democratic Party officials and others had been anxiously waiting to see if the Russian hackers who had broken into the DNC would do any more with the documents they had stolen. The suspected Russian front, Guccifer 2.0, had posted some DNC documents, but none had been terribly damaging. Yet there had been an ominous forewarning. Guccifer 2.0 had claimed he had given the main part of the papers, thousands of files and mails, to WikiLeaks. Now, Assange and WikiLeaks were proving Guccifer 2.0 right. 2 hours after that tweet, they posted a trove of hacked DNC emails in one of their biggest political document dumps ever. If the primary purpose of Russian information warfare operations, as outlined in the Gerasimov Doctrine, was to sow confusion and exploit divisions within the adversary, the WikiLeaks release could not have worked better. From the moment WikiLeaks disseminated the DNC emails, it was clear this dump would stoke anger among Bernie Sanders supporters and incite insurrection at the Democratic Convention. Several emails showed top DNC officials favoring Clinton, privately deriding Sanders staffers, and swapping ideas to undercut the Vermont senator's campaign. In one email, Wasserman Schultz referred to Jeff Weaver, Sanders' campaign manager, as a damn liar. In another, she responded to a Weaver vow to continue the Sanders campaign until the convention and noted, "He is an ass." One especially embarrassing email chain began with Brad Marshall, the DNC's chief financial officer, proposing to other DNC officials a line of attack regarding Sanders' religious beliefs, or lack thereof. He wrote, "Can we get someone to ask his belief? Does he believe in a God? He had skated on saying he has a Jewish heritage. I think I read he is an atheist. My Southern Baptist peeps would draw a big difference between a Jew and an atheist." Clearly, he was suggesting something of a smear job. In the email thread, Dacey, the DNC's chief executive officer, replied, "Amen." "I picked the wrong word and I regretted it," Dacey later said. "I was just trying to shut down the conversation." And in a May 21, 2016 message to Luis Miranda, the DNC communications director, Mark Paustenbach, his deputy, raised an idea for a story they could pitch to a political reporter. "Wondering if there's a good Bernie narrative for a story, which is that Bernie never ever had his act together, that his campaign was a mess." There was no evidence the DNC ever acted on either of these ideas, but it didn't matter. By the time Sanders delegates arrived in Philadelphia, they were hopping mad. "It was kind of like a punch in the gut," Robert Becker, the Sanders campaign floor manager for the convention, recalled. "It was the tenor and tone of some of those emails. These weren't volunteers chittering and chattering. This was the leadership of the party. I was literally offended. And to have them mock the Bernie campaign, it was like, what the fuck have you guys built over the last year?" And Trump was more than happy to fuel the flames. "Leaked emails of DNC show plans to destroy Bernie Sanders," he tweeted. "Mock his heritage and much more. Online from WikiLeaks, really vicious. Rigged." In another tweet, he gleefully asserted, "The WikiLeaks email released today was so bad to Sanders that it will make it impossible for him to support her unless he is a fraud." This was the last thing the Clinton campaign needed at the moment its primary goal was to bring a divided party together. As the campaign's senior officials huddled about how to respond, they had little doubt about what was going on and who was behind it. "We viewed it as a conscious effort to divide the party at a key party gathering," said Jake Sullivan, Clinton's top national security advisor. "Our reaction was we were under attack by the Russians." and when campaign manager Mook talked to Clinton about the release of the DNC emails, she told him she was convinced it was Putin's payback against her. "Next, they're going to put polonium in my tea," she joked. She was referring to another Russian intelligence operation, the 2006 assassination of Alexander Litvinenko. Luis Miranda himself was enraged. He was driving back to Washington, D.C. from the convention in Cleveland when WikiLeaks began dumping the DNC emails. His emails made up more than half of the cash posted. Much of the rest came from members of the DNC's fundraising team. He was the number one target, his privacy violated, his communications made public. The DNC lawyers at Perkins Coie found it puzzling that the hackers had not swiped and released emails from Dacey and other senior DNC officials. At rest stops and Starbucks along the way, Miranda encountered reporters also returning from the GOP convention, and they were asking him about individual emails. Miranda saw that many, though not all, of the emails fueling the DNC screwed Sanders argument had come from the past May. That was after the DNC in late April had discovered that Russian hackers had violated its network, and before CrowdStrike had booted out the intruders in early June. Miranda wondered why the cybersecurity experts had waited 6 weeks to turn off the network. To him, it seemed as if the DNC and CrowdStrike had watched burglars freely roam in and out of the network, pilfering material for weeks, and not warned DNC staffers that their communications were open to theft. Though the DNC's lawyers believed CrowdStrike's remediation effort had been conducted as quickly as possible, and that the DNC brass had no choice but to keep the infiltration a secret from its employees, Miranda couldn't get over the timing. The most damaging emails in the WikiLeaks dump had been swiped after the DNC already knew it had been hacked. The timing was especially cruel for Miranda and his DNC colleagues. It was in May that party professionals were most annoyed at Sanders. By then, Clinton had achieved a lock on the nomination. As they saw it, Sanders' refusal to bow out and endorse Clinton was the petulant self-indulgence of a vain man who didn't care about party unity. It was no surprise that the emails from this stretch reflected their frustration with Sanders and his campaign staffers. But the timing of when these damning emails had been written got lost in the commotion they were causing. Within the Clinton campaign, there was debate about how far they should go in responding to the WikiLeaks dump. All the senior staff wanted to get the word out that this was a Russian hit job. CrowdStrike and other cybersecurity experts had concluded that. But Mook, who by now had been briefed by campaign lawyer Mark Elias on some of the contents of the explosive steel memos, wanted to go further. He proposed saying that the Russians were using WikiLeaks as part of a plot to elect Trump. "Everything is telling us that this is true, so what are we waiting for?" Mook argued to his colleagues. Other Clinton officials were reticent and pushed back. "No one wanted to come off sounding crazy," recalled Mook. "It was hard to believe. It was Tom Clancy-ish and fictional." The Clinton aides agreed that Mook and others doing interviews could continue asserting that Moscow was intervening in the election, but they would stop short of saying it was for the benefit of Trump. The only problem was the media wasn't buying it either way. On Sunday morning, Mook appeared on CNN's State of the Union. As soon as host Jake Tapper asked him about the DNC emails and the party's treatment of Sanders in the primaries, Mook turned toward Russia. "Experts are telling us that Russian state actors broke into the DNC, stole these emails, and other experts are now saying that the Russians are releasing these emails for the purpose of actually helping Donald Trump." So much for the campaign guidance. But Mook had other evidence to cite. He pointed to the weakening of the Ukrainian plank at the GOP convention and Trump's declaration that he might not honor the United States' NATO commitments. "When you put all this together," he said, "it's a disturbing picture. And I think voters need to reflect on that." Tapper pressed Mook for proof. What evidence is there that the Russians were behind this in terms of the hacking or in terms of the timing by WikiLeaks? Mook referred to the cybersecurity experts who had reached this conclusion. But, Tapper countered, it is a very, very strong charge that you're leveling here. You're basically suggesting that Russians hacked into the DNC and now are releasing these files through WikiLeaks to help elect Donald Trump.